You are listening to the Signature Books Podcast.
Welcome to the Signature Books Podcast. My name is Devery Anderson, and I am Marketing Manager here at Signature Books. And today, my guest is Noel Carmack, and he's co-editor of forthcoming volume, along with Charles Hatch, of a two-volume set called Useful to the Church and Kingdom, The Journals of James H. Martineau, Pioneer and Patriarch, 1850 to 1918. Now, these diaries are a very important record detailing early Utah, mid-century to the early 20th century, as the title implies. We're honored to be publishing these, and they'll be out shortly. Martineau converted to Mormonism in 1850 and spent his life as a surveyor, mapmaker, civil engineer, and leader in the Utah Territorial Militia. And he witnessed and took part in several events in the territory and worked on the Union Pacific Railroad. His journal spans 68 years, and as I mentioned, it's one of the most important diaries kept in 19th century Utah. When you buy the book and take a look at it, the annotation is really superb in this volume. So a little bit about Noel Carmack. He's associate professor of art at Utah State University Eastern. He's published in BYU Studies, Dialogue, Journal of Mormon Thought, and elsewhere. And he's co-editor with Karen Lynn Davidson of Out of the Black Patch, the autobiography of F.E. Marquess Carmack, folk musician, artist, and writer. All right, Noel, welcome to the Signature Books Podcast. It's great to have you here.
Thanks, Devery. It was nice to be here.
All right. Well, you must be excited. I know you put in a lot of work on these two volumes of the Martineau journals. And so to kind of set the stage here, a lot of our listeners may not know much or anything about James Martineau. So can you just take a few minutes to fill us in who he was?
Sure, absolutely. James Henry Martineau was not born into the LDS Church. He was born in Montgomery Port Jackson, New York, upstate New York, in March of 1828. And he was born in, I wouldn't say they were affluent, but they were probably middle class Americans at the time. And his father was an engineer, took part in working on the Croton Aqueduct in New York City, which still stands today. He also had some patents for several inventions. So Martineau was born into a family of fairly educated and more of a middle-class, upper-middle-class family. And then he attended a military academy as a young man, was enlisted in the, I guess it would have been the Mexican-American War of 48. And then following his release from that, he decided to go west to Salt Lake or west to California to join the gold seekers. And so he traveled the usual route of the immigrants, and he entered into Salt Lake City and decided to stay over and rest for the winter. That would have been the winter of 1850-1851. And he stayed in the Salt Lake area. He stayed in Farmington for a short time and worked for William Walker. And then he was called to, I should get to this. He decided that he wanted to learn about the Mormons. And he read a couple of tracts. He talked to some people, and he felt like he wanted to join the church. And so he was baptized there in City Creek, right there in Salt Lake City, and decided to stay. Decided to stay among them, and wasn't very long after that he was sent down to Iron County to help in the settlements. But he was sent to Parowan to help with that settlement. So he joined with the group and went down and was there in 1851 with George A. Smith, who was heading that colonization down there. And he stayed in Parowan for the next, 9 years. And during that time, he struggled economically. There really wasn't much money flow down there. And the ironworks wasn't very successful. It was kind of failing. And he was really desperate to make money. And so he started surveying the farms and tracts around in the Iron County area. So with that brief introduction to coming into Utah, converting to the Latter-day Saint Church, he began to learn from William Dame, in fact, how to survey. He'd already probably learned some in the military academy about not only military tactics, but engineering. But with William Dame's instruction, he was able to learn a little bit about surveying and began to survey Parowan, Paragona. He went up to Beaver and surveyed up in Beaver. So he began to survey these communities around Parowan and Cedar City and so forth, and was very good at it. He found that he really enjoyed doing it. Meanwhile, of course, the doctrine of polygamy was announced. And when was that? 1854, I believe he learned about it in the newspaper in Deseret News. And that became a little bit of a challenge. Although while he was there in Parowan, he was surrounded by people who had lived and listened to the founding prophet Joseph Smith talk about polygamy. And many of them had already committed to the practice of polygamy. And so here he was in Parowan, surrounded by people who had been in the shadow and within the voice of the founding prophet, Joseph Smith. And he learned about polygamy, not only from the tracts that he read, Orson Pratt and others. He was able to see firsthand how people lived in the practice. And so after marrying his first wife, Susan Ellen Johnson, the daughter of Joel Hill Johnson, he decided he was going to conform to the practice of polygamy. And in fact, Susan Ellen really urged him to find another wife. And he really kind of struggled with it. But he met Benjamin Franklin Johnson, who had been a confidant of Joseph Smith in Nauvoo and earlier, and found out that the daughter of Lyman Sherman, who both of her parents had passed. Lyman Sherman had died, I think, in 1838, and his widowed wife, Delcina, married, according to rumor, Joseph Smith, and yet she died a couple of years later, leaving Susan Julia an orphan child. And as an orphan, they put her in the care of Benjamin Franklin Johnson, who was Delcina's brother. And so she was living with Uncle Ben, they called him. She was living with Uncle Ben, and he noted that he was kind of attracted to her. And she thought that, and he thought that she was as well. And they began to talk. James Henry was a member of the territorial legislature. And I can't remember in what capacity. I think he might have been a clerk. But he was traveling up north to attend the territorial meetings. On his way back, he would stop and stay at the home of Benjamin Johnson in Santaquin. And that's where he started to court Susan Julia, who ended up being his first wife. So that's a little introduction to James Henry, who, after a series of moves, he became, one of the best noted, one of the most respected surveyors in the territory.
All right. Well, thanks for that background. And I know his journals span several years, and editing a documentary history is no easy task. And so what led you to the project of editing and publishing these diaries?
It's an interesting question. I was just thinking about that, and your listeners will know this, but I started out in special collections and archives up at Utah State University. under the direction of A.J. Simmons, Andrew Jeffrey Simmons, who passed away in 1995. But when I worked with A.J., one of the many people that he introduced me to was James Henry Martineau, because he knew that I was an artist. My training, my background is in art, two-dimensional art. And so A.J. introduced me to James Henry Martineau for his map making. He said, you've got to see James Henry's maps, and I think you'll really love to see his ability to draw and to make these beautiful plats, of course, but mostly plats, but he also did quite a few maps. And he got me hooked. I was hooked from the very beginning on James Henry Martineau. So I read as much as I could about him and his time in Logan. So, of course, after he was in Parowan, he decided to move north because a lot of people were moving north to Logan. And he took his wives and went north. And he found a place right off of the square, just next to the tabernacle. He began to survey for a lot of the farmers in the Logan area. So he began to survey. He would extend the farm surveys for Logan and Paradise, all of the communities in Cache Valley. And so those plat maps, those farm surveys are still in existence. They were held at the county recorder's office. And then, of course, USU Special Collections photographed them. And then eventually some of those original plats are at Special Collections. And that's where I began my interest in James Henry Martineau. In 1998, I kind of came across his letters to his wives, and I began to write an article, and it was published in the Historical Quarterly of 2000. It's the volume 68 of the Utah Historical Quarterly. From there, I tried to look for everything I could. I gave a paper at the Historical Society meeting in Logan prior to publishing the article, and I just happened to ran into Ev Cooley, who was still living at that time, and he had been in my session when I delivered my paper on James Martineau. And he came up to me and he said, you know, one of the things that I would really like to see before I die is the Martineau diaries published. And my ears perked up because it was then that Ev told me about the existence of the diaries, that they were being kept in a vault and by a descendant, an attorney, somewhere in Southern California. So my ears perked up, and I even tried to pursue. I spoke to the gentleman who I believe was in possession of the diaries, and at that time he really wasn't ready to make them known or to release them. But it wasn't until the fall of 2006 that I got a phone call from, and I don't remember who called me first, but I got a phone call from Bill McKinnon, who told me that a photocopy of the diaries were deposited at the Huntington Library in San Marino, California. And then I think it might have been Richard who called me next and said, hey, you've got to come and see these diaries. They're just magnificent. You've got to come in and take a look at the Martineau diaries. And so I immediately got a flight, and I flew to L.A., and I spent a couple days looking at the photocopy there at the Huntington Library. At that very moment, I thought, we've got to get these published. So that was the beginning. I joined forces with my old friend, Charles Hatch, who bless his soul, he passed away last November. But I knew that Chick would produce a really wonderful transcript of the diaries. And so we got photocopies of the diaries and for the Special Collections, but I was able to make those copies, and we let Chick do the transcription. And it took a number of years, but we got that done, and I began doing the annotations immediately. We made a few trips. I applied for some research fellowships. So yeah, I mean, it kind of the whole project was sort of launched in the spring, I would say, of 2007. And from there, I kind of spent a lot of stops and starts, but we got it going.
Well, after 16 years, they're done. And I was going to tell you, we got the proofs in the other day, and so I got to hold them in my hands now, and they're really beautiful. They turned out great.
Yeah,
I'm really. So yeah, it'll be fun to when we get our actual copies, because I'm anxious to have mine and just add it to my library. You've already mentioned about my next question I wanted to ask, of course, was about him as a surveyor, and you've already touched on that pretty well. I guess I'm curious, how long did he work as a surveyor? How long was that his profession?
Oh my goodness. He was a surveyor from the time he was in, probably began surveying 1852, 53, might have been a little bit later than that, and then continued surveying until he was aged. He was an old man. in fact, it's really pretty remarkable, but I would say he finished up in about 1905. I think one of the things that those who read the diaries will find that he was an old man climbing up in the high Uintas to survey a contract with the government, and was in the high Uintas as a, 80 some year old man.
Oh, wow.
He was old.
And he lived until 1921, right? And so,
right. Yeah.
And he was born in 1828. So yeah. So he was, 90,
maybe not quite 80 ish, but yeah, you do the math. And yeah, it was, I want to say it was 1904 or 5 that he was working on his contract in the Uintas.
So he was around 93 when he died. Is that?
That sounds right.
Right. Yeah. Wow. So long life, long and important record. And so, and we published it and look forward to it, everybody. All right. Some things stand out in the diaries. There's a lot to do with indigenous peoples, conflicts with natives, and fears of Indian attacks.
Right.
Can you just discuss some of this? Just kind of just a general question about it, but maybe you could just answer.
Sure. Well, of course, he was in Iron County when the Mountain Meadows Massacre took place. At the time, he was on a scout up the Sevier River. He didn't learn of the attacks until he came back. But he was in southern Utah when there were a lot of native attacks, and so his introduction to the natives, to the Indians, was initially, it was negative. He felt them, violent and more as almost like savages, really. And even when he moved up to Logan, the Shoshones were Shoshone Indians were attacking fairly frequently in the 1860s. And of course, he was up in Logan when Bear River Massacre took place. So he encountered natives throughout his time in the territory. And had a pretty negative view of the natives. Now, another thing that he encountered were children who were being traded or sold by the natives,
right?
Which I think was problematic for obviously a number of reasons. But Brigham Young had basically said that for settlers to trade and buy the native children was a compassionate duty. It was a way to save these kids from who knows what, demise. The Pahids and the Paiutes were, I think, victims. They traded their children. I'm not sure what their motivations were, other than maybe just, economic, getting goods and services for trading the children, but James was not he wasn't above buying the native children, and he had at least two that came into his care, and it was through that native trade that by most accounts is a negative thing, but the settlers felt like they were doing a compassionate service or a duty to save these kids from being abused and sometimes killed.
So were they, when they were taken in like that, did they become part of the family, were raised as children in the family?
They were raised as children, and two of James's Indian children he adopted, and they became his part of his family, Cora and Dora. He spoke of them as his daughters. You know, they became his children.
And do you get a sense of how prevalent this was?
I think it was fairly widespread. I think it was fairly common, especially in the southern settlements, for these children to be left or to be traded. Otherwise, I mean, there was no telling what would have happened to them. I think they treated those kids like they were animals. You know, it was terrible.
An annotated version of Martineau's journals was published back in 2008. And that being the case, why did you feel that these new annotated versions were necessary?
That's an interesting question. You know, that has come up a couple of times. And, I actually wrote a book review for the Journal of Mormon History. I think it was in 2009. And, you know, reader, our listeners, I guess, should maybe refer to that for more in-depth review of that version. But that version undoubtedly filled a need for the family to have a good published edition of the journals. The editors, Rebecca Martineau McCarty and Donald Godfrey, were apparently commissioned by the family organization to produce an edition of the journals that was accessible. I felt it was kind of a reflection of what was then known about Martineau in published accounts and family histories. I would let readers compare the level of annotation in the two versions, but I'll let them judge when they do the comparison. But I think they'll find that the signature books version contains more informative, accurate information in the annotations. I tried to search as many manuscript sources and newspaper articles as possible. So what you're getting in the signature books version is more up to date and accurate in my view. You know, you can go back and look at the RSC version and you will see that they really produced a really wonderful transcription. But as I said in the book review, it was somewhat deficient in terms of the annotations. It really didn't provide what I would say is adequate context to the journals. And you would find that I really feel that people are going to be pleased with what they find in the notes here in this version.
Okay, great. So what they bring to the table then, you'd say, is that the annotation. And I noticed that in looking over the version we're publishing, is that the annotation was stellar. And so that's the main difference, you'd say then, right?
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. We really tried to search all available sources, including correspondence. I really spent a lot of time in the Martineau collection at the LDS Church History Library, and actually was awarded several research grants to visit archives. I actually went to National Archives in California. It was actually at Laguna Niguel, which has since moved to the Bay Area. But I found some materials in various collections that I think really are really previously unknown, and including some photographs that the family and scholars will, I think, appreciate in these versions.
All right, wonderful. And you mentioned that James Henry Martineau had a close association with William H. Dame, who was a Parowan state president and militia commander who authorized Isaac Haight's request to carry out the Mountain Meadows Massacre in 1857. What do Martineau's journals reveal about this atrocity, as well as the legal case against Dame in the 1870s?
It's interesting, an interesting question, because this is where I think the journals may not be as useful to the massacre scholars as they would hope to be, hope they would be. I wouldn't say that he didn't make meaningful comments about the massacre in his journals, but he did write several comments in there that I think might be enlightening. Readers won't find any zingers in there regarding the massacre. Martineau happened to be, at the time, he was on a scouting expedition up the Sevier River when the massacre took place. So he had gone up exploring in an exploring party, actually went up to Fish Lake and came back. And then upon his return, he discovered that the massacre had taken place. And actually, this is what he writes in his journal. He says, "On arriving home, I found Colonel Dame had just gone south to Mountain Meadows to try and stop the slaughter of a company of immigrants who had been attacked there by the Indians. We afterwards learned that when he arrived there, he found them all killed, but 15 or 20 little children. The eldest, about 8 years of age, which had been saved by the whites. The company numbered over 100 souls. The company had poisoned 6 Pavants at Corn Creek, which greatly enraged all the Indians from that place south, which was the cause of the massacre." Now, from this entry, we can see, or we can derive, that he was kind of relating what he'd been told about the massacre, and he pretty much stuck to that story. He later wrote an article that was published in a newspaper. It was called the El Progreso, and it was published in 1907. And he pretty much stuck to the same circulating stories about the massacre, even at that date.
Oh, so interesting.
But, he did spend a lot of time with William Dame. And in fact, Martineau learned his skills as a surveyor from William Dame, probably back as early as 1855 and 54, 55, when he was helping him survey in the southern settlements. So they probably spent quite a bit of time out in the field, and Martineau learned his surveying skills from Dame. So they knew each other for a long time, spent a lot of time together. Martineau was a second lieutenant in the militia. He served as the adjutant and knew what was, basically taught the militia, the military tactics that he had learned, as a soldier. So yeah, they did know each other, and they spent a lot of time together. Now, to answer your question about, Dame was tried in 1858 or something like that. And in Martineau's journal, he talks about his relationship with Dame and being he was there for the trial. I can read you a little bit of that if you want. There's a passage here that he talks about.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So here he says, "On August 10th, 1858, for 3 days, Elders George A. Smith and Amasa Lyman have been examining and trying the case of President Dame, who has been charged with a long list of misdemeanors, some charges running back for a time of 5 years. This list of charges was signed by all the officers of this branch, except C.C. Pendleton and myself. Brother Dame was much cast down when he showed me the charges against him, saying that although he was innocent, no one would believe it with so many names against him, there being one of his own counselors, the bishop and council, and all the high council but myself. I told him I knew he was innocent and would stick to him to the last. If he fell, I would go with him. After a most searching investigation, Brother Dame came out unscathed. Brother George A. Smith saying Brother Dame had not made half as many mistakes in the last 5 years as he himself had." He really was faithful in terms of his friendship with Colonel Dame. and actually, you know, supported him in that trial.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, that's interesting. All right. Thanks for that. And you also mentioned that he was a polygamist. And so I'm just like to talk a little more detail about his family life. How many wives, how many kids, over what period of time, if you know?
Okay. I mentioned that he married the daughter of Lyman Sherman.
Sherman, yeah.
And Delsina Johnson. But he married two other living women. Well, his second plural wife was Mary Eliza Brown Jones, and he married her in 1877. And then he later married Jesse Helen Russell Anderson Greaves. And I think both of these women at the time they married James Henry were widows. But he married Jesse Greaves in 1887. This was shortly after the act. I can't think of the name of it.
What year would that? Was it Edmunds Tucker? Was that in?
The Edmunds Act. Yes, I believe it was one of the first ones. And he described it in the diaries that it was done in darkness and the officiator was behind a curtain. You know, I'm sure it had to do with, you know, liability for if they were ever caught that they could say that they didn't witness any marriage. So he married three plural wives in addition to his first wife, Susan Ellen Johnson.
Yeah. And one of those he never really even lived with, right? Or her mother was against the whole thing. Was that considered a marriage? Like, did they consider themselves still married to each other just without a relationship because of the mother?
Yes. I think you're referring to Jesse. And both Mary Eliza Jones and Jesse Greaves. They didn't really ever live under his roof. They lived in, Mary was in Salt Lake, and I think Jesse was in Salt Lake for a time and then later moved to California. And they wrote back and forth. There are references to that in the diaries. And it's very coy and almost secretive in the diaries, but when you recognize who he's referring to, he's talking about those plural wives that he was communicating with. But yeah, I believe it was Jesse's mother did not approve of the marriage. And there was some difficulty there, but they didn't live under the same roof, but they stayed together, and he still had fond feelings for both of them.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And so we talk about him going to Parowan. Now, he was he was called to settle that. He was the kind of the central figure that settled it, right? Was he? I mean, there were others that would have been, you know, part of it.
Yeah. Well, George A. Smith was sort of the authority in charge of the settlements down there. And James Henry Martineau was one of many of the settlers and became kind of he became a clerk. He was a counselor to the state president. His name escapes me at the moment, but he became a counselor in the state presidency. John, I can't think of his name.
Well, read the book, everybody. You'll find.
but he became a counselor in the state presidency. He was highly regarded because of his education. He participated in plays down there. I don't know if you're aware, but the people of Parowan produced plays, and they had a band, and he participated in some of that. I think he helped to make some of the sets, the backdrops and things like that. But James Henry was, was highly respected. I don't know if you remember several years ago, I published an article on the murder of a little boy named Isaac Whitehouse. And he was a boy who came in with a man and a woman that had joined in marriage on the plains west, probably in Kansas City or perhaps in St. Louis. I don't remember, but they were married, and the child was the son of the woman's, I think it was her sister and brother-in-law, and they had passed away on the trip. And so the boy was left orphaned and left in the care of this woman and her husband, and they abused the boy, and he was beaten, and he was found beaten in the ditch just just outside of the town. And James Henry was called, he and Calvin Pendleton, I think his was his name, were called as witnesses, and he reluctantly went up to Fillmore to serve as a witness in the trial of Samuel Baker and his wife for killing this boy, 10-year-old boy. But you can read about that in both Connell O'Donovan and I, we both published separate articles on that same tragic murder in 1854,
1855. Oh, okay.
Oh, but yeah.
I imagine the Martineau Diaries were, was that a major source for you for the story?
Yeah, the diaries were a source. I also found some letters in the George A. Smith collection. And actually the Hosea Stout diaries was another source for that trial, the White House or the Samuel Baker murder trial.
And what publication was your article in?
That was in the Utah Historical Quarterly.
Okay.
And then Connell's came out at the same time, and it came out in the Journal of Mormon History.
Did you guys know you were both doing this, or did it just?
Well, no. It's funny because I found out that I had submitted mine, and Connell had gotten his accepted for the Journal of Mormon History, and mine had been accepted, but it wasn't coming out to the next issue. But we managed to work it out so that they came out at the same time. It worked out really well. And Connell and I, you know, we've been friends ever since. And we actually did an interview with the Quarterly on that. And so you can actually listen to our interview.
Oh, okay. Nice. So, Martineau also spent a long time, like around 20 years or so. Do I have that right? In Logan. His time there, it's interesting. He spent a lot of time in the temple, and he seemed to be an avid genealogist as well. And so you want to just talk about that a little bit, because that seemed to be a great passion.
Yeah. So I just gave a paper in Rochester about James Henry's plural marriages. And I did some investigating, and I really believe that he had read Benjamin Franklin Johnson's defense of polygamy that came out just shortly after Pratt's defense of defenses of polygamy that were published in the Seer. And we all know about the Seer. It was a serialized publication that was full of the different biblical and latter-day doctrinal defenses of polygamy. Anyway, James Martineau undoubtedly read those defenses, and I think that was instrumental in his decision or his confirmation of the practice, and it helped him decide to conform to it. But getting back to your question, it was because of that he knew that he needed to record and keep a good record of his genealogy and the work for the dead that he would do in the temple when the temple was completed. And that was the other thing that he was converted to or committed to doing was keeping a genealogical record. One of the tracts that he talked about in his conversion was Spencer's Letters. And if you go in and read Spencer's Letters, he talks about the importance of keeping a genealogical record as a testament, basically, that that the work, the temple work, was legitimate, that it was sanctified and legitimate. And so he did a lot of temple work in the Logan Temple, just prolific, you know, and he did a lot of his own family and the families of some notable Americans did it in the Logan Temple and did a lot of temple work there. In fact, I would venture to say that a large part of the early work that was done in the Logan Temple was James Martineau's own work, vicarious work.
Yeah. And when you read his diary, he's like, you know, begins as an autobiography before he, you know, gets into the day-to-day right. activities and stuff. And he tells a lot of stories about his family, his parents, grandparents, and that. And he was able to collect those stories. Oftentimes people will write and say that they'd heard this about a family member, an ancestor, or whatever, but he had a lot of great detail about his ancestry, which I thought was really, you know, I'm used to having the internet to help us find stuff today, yeah. you know. And so he had all this information that, you know, he learned or gathered, or I don't know how much of it was passed down, but he clearly took an interest and wanted to preserve all of this stuff. And yeah. the encounters his parents had with, you know, kind of well-known people or whatever. And I just thought it was fascinating that he was able to write the kind of detail he did.
I think that he was like many young, educated men, young men at the time who were trained probably in the military academy, but also through their public schooling, to keep good records. And so I think young men were taught in grammar and stenography and all that kind of thing. And so I think he when he arrived in Salt Lake, he had already had this upbringing in keeping good records, because that's not only was he an outstanding surveyor and engineer, but he was a record keeper, and he was often called to serve as a clerk or a secretary of some sort, keeping records. And so that is reflected in his yeah. his family, you know, genealogy.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, he seemed to have a pretty good life, you know, when he was living in Logan. And then he ups and moves to Mexico, and his diary entries are so much about all the suffering, basically praying every day, pray that he can just get through another day, you know, impoverished, it sounded like, and all of that. And why did he go to Mexico? It seemed like his whole life changed when he did, from good to just suffering.
Yeah, it's interesting.
What years did that cover again?
He was called to Pima down in Gila Valley in Arizona, and then he went. It was probably, I'd have to look at the timeline, but about 1892 or three, he went on some scouting parties with Moses Thatcher and went down and looked for places for the early saints to colonize down in northern Mexico. Because of his experience as a topographer and a surveyor, map maker, he was asked to accompany these church leaders like Moses Thatcher and others, John Young and others, to go down and to help settle the northern colonies in Mexico. So it was really in answer to, you know, being asked to do it. He always complied. He always said yes. He never turned those callings down. You know, it had to do with his commitment to the church. I want to, with that question, it made me think of his proposal letter to Susan Julia Sherman, his first plural wife. After courting her for a period of time, he decided that he wanted to ask for her hand in marriage, and he sent her a letter, a proposal. And I want to read this to you because I think it kind of answers the question. It says, I am not rich, neither am I poor. I do not know that I ever shall be very well off, nor do I wish to be, but rather to spend myself with all I have, if necessary, for the good of the kingdom. My interests and feelings and hopes are all identified with Mormonism, and consequently, if the church prospers, I hope to prosper with it. If the church suffers persecution, distress, and poverty, I hope to suffer with it. These are my principles in short. If they suit you, if you are perfectly willing to accept and be guided by them, if you are willing to become my wife according to the order of heaven, you can inform me by return mail or at your earliest convenience. So he was clear in his dedication, his commitment to the church and doing anything to help the church prosper. In fact, he corresponded with Brigham Young on several occasions, asking for permission to do this or that. And Brigham always came back and said, you continue in your surveying. And he said to the effect, I want you to be useful in the church and kingdom. And that's where the title of the, that's where,
right.
And got the title for the diary. So he that was his thing, was to be useful in the church and kingdom, to do whatever was necessary.
And that comes out a lot in the diaries. He talks about his faith a lot. When you think about that, you think of the number of years, just how long the diary spans and the number of years he was in the church and, doing and going wherever he was asked to go. It's another one of these cases where you read these 19th century records and all the sacrifice they put into establishing this kingdom in the West. It's really quite remarkable what people were willing to do. And he's clear, it's clear to me that he just throughout that whole process just maintained his faith and, he joins the church and doesn't really look back.
That really was what was remarkable to me when I began researching James Henry Martineau's life and his efforts. No matter what it was, he was completely immersed, completely committed to the church, and doing whatever it took to help the church prosper. And he's just one of many. I'm sure that people could say that about any number of men like him, but James Henry Martineau really was, to me, was a pretty remarkable person, and what he did, to help the settlements in Utah and Arizona and in Mexico. It's just an amazing, amazing life story.
And there were many men like him. How would you rate his, I imagine you've had a chance to examine diaries of different people over the years.
Yeah.
Where does his rate among the diaries that you've looked at, especially the ones that, if people want to, learn, and these diaries are great primary sources for researching and writing on Pioneer Utah and the later period, because his life goes into the 20th century. Those sources that make such, that are such important sources to learning Utah history, where does his rate, where would you say his rates over, within all the different ones you've personally examined?
I think his diary is every bit as good as a Hosea Stout diary or a James Bleak diary. What I think strikes me about James Henry Martineau's journals or diaries is that he's very, you know that he's writing to his children. He expects that his children are going to read these diaries at some point. And so he's very candid. He talks about his feelings about, Susan Julia, or he talks about his, how difficult, some this or that was, climbing, this mountain, or, he talks about surveying down near, it was down near Tucson, and it was 116 degrees, and he was crawling around in the under these Palo Verde trees, and described it as one of the most difficult jobs he's ever had in his entire life, because it was so hot, it was so blistering hot. But you don't get that in a lot of that kind of detail in other diaries.
Right.
The amount of detail. There's some things that he obviously leaves out, but so much that's descriptive and insightful. I would rate him up there with some of the best. Like, Jose Stout, of course, and Juanita Brooks did a brilliant job with those diaries. And we've seen so many others, you guys have published a lot of them, the Mass Alignment journals are great. But I would rate James Henry Martineau's diaries right up there. Let me add this, that his diary is one of the very few diaries of men who worked on the Transcontinental Railroad. We just don't have, there are only a handful of diaries of men who worked on the railroad, daily diaries that talked about what they were doing. To me, it's remarkable. It's almost a one of a kind record. I've only found a couple other diaries like that.
We're definitely honored to be publishing it.
Yeah.
And it is important and sheds a lot of light on a lot of stuff from that early Utah period. It's interesting. He came to Salt Lake for the dedication of the Salt Lake Temple in 1896. I get that and statehood mixed up for some reason.
Yeah, I do
1893
too.
For the temple, right?
Yeah. Okay, 1896
yeah. for statehood. But he was perturbed by the open house and that just people could come walking through the temple, I guess, and it bothered him quite a bit. You want to talk about that and why was he so troubled by that?
I think that it was, he's very, as time went on, he just became so dedicated to the church and his testimony was strengthened. But his testimony of temple work and temples in general, I'm only guessing, that he just felt like that was almost like an offense, to have people just walking through. Traipsing through the house of the Lord. And so I think that that's the kind of thing that would have disturbed him in that regard, was having some people just kind of walking through without in his view, the regard for the sacredness of it.
Well, it'll be happening again in a year or two, right?
Right. Yes. Yeah.
So, he won't be around to see it this time. So maybe he'll be rolling in his grave or something, but
I have to tell you about, and I think it's mentioned in the diaries, but he actually wrote an article about it. But he was disturbed. He was asked to help Jesse Fox lay out the Logan Temple, and they laid it according to the Polaris. They wanted it perfectly east west, and apparently James Henry felt that Jesse Fox had not done it properly, and he complained about it to Brigham Young. I think Brigham just basically said, just let it go. It's not that big a deal. But James Henry was really disturbed by that. So, yeah. I'm kind of likening it to that mention of that, of people walking through the Salt Lake Temple for the dedication. He just had that kind of a high regard for the sacredness of temples and temple works, that it had to be done right. It had to be done perfectly, and in a sacred, sacred manner,
Right. Well, he was an interesting guy, and to think that it just, this whole record and that life as a surveyor, his settling Parowan, all the work he did, had he not just been on his way to California as part of the gold rush, and got sidetracked by Mormonism, basically, none of this would have happened.
Right,
yeah. So it adds to how just interesting this whole.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really remarkable that he was in so many places at the right times of our history of the LDS Church in Utah and in the colonies, in the northern colonies in Mexico. he was there. He was there at the documented the Bear River Massacre. He was there for the Transcontinental Railroad. He was there for settling the southern settlements in Iron County, in Gila Valley, and then down in Mexico. It's just remarkable that he was there for almost all of it, you know.
Yeah, no, it's great, and it's great that it spans so many years, especially when you're a good record keeper and a good journalist like that, you know, covering all that. I'm writing a biography of Willard Richards. I've been working on that forever, and his journals could have been so much better. It's frustrating sometimes when I read his journals, like, why didn't you say more about this, or why did you leave a whole month blank and just write, oh, for meaning I was in the office all day. So, well, what were you doing in the office? Who came and saw you? And what did you discuss with Joe? He was worked in the office with Joseph Smith. So what did you two discuss, you know? And sometimes I say, you know, if he wasn't already dead, I'd kill him. So that's how I feel, because reading a diary that had potential, and he was such a, you know, important figure, that his diaries could have been so much better. I really appreciate those who did write well and go into detail and consider their record something of value.
You know, Joe Geisner, you know, ran into you at the presentation the other night at Benchmark Books, and Joe mentioned that Will Bagley really wasn't that interested in the James Martineau diaries because something about them being a kind of a copy. I mentioned to Joe, I said, well, what Will may have been referring to was the fact that James Henry Martineau kept pocket diaries in his pocket, wherever he went, or in his saddlebag, and would write in the moment, but then later would transfer the information in the pocket diaries to his larger diaries, which is what we have. And so I said that it could be that Will is referring to this idea that perhaps, James edited things out, and that's true. There could be things that he kept out for whatever reason, you know, that it was maybe a little bit too revealing or too sacred or something. But I'm really astounded by how much he left in. You know, he's left in a lot of detail.
No, it's really good. I just want to remind people that it's a 2-volume set, because it was much too much information for one. And the title here is Useful to the Church and Kingdom, the Journals of James H. Martineau, Pioneer and Patriarch, 1850 to 1918. And that 1850 to 1918 is the years of the diary, not his of life, because that was 1828 to 1921. So the diaries then span 68 years. And so, you know, that just adds to just how unique and how important these diaries are. And so I want to whet everybody's appetites that 2 volumes, some very rich history preserved here, and some very important primary document. And Noel Carmack and Charles Hatch worked hard to edit these and bring them to us, and Signature's proud to publish it. So it's been a pleasure talking to you today, giving us some background, highlighting some gems of the diaries and of his life.
And, well, thanks so much to you, DeVree, and to your compadres there at Signature Books for seeing the importance of the diaries. And I'm really excited to see them in print. They're going to be I think they're going to be really incredible for people to read.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, thanks a lot for joining me today, Noel, and we will talk to you again.
Okay. Thanks so much.